Global South Pole, a program presented to you by Sputnik Africa. Greetings and welcome to Global South Pole podcast, your platform for insightful discussions on global affairs from a unique perspective. I am your host, Aliu Bello. Today, we delve into a complex and controversial organization, the Commonwealth of Nations. Since its establishment in 1926, the bloc has undergone the evolution from the ashes of the British Empire to an exploitative association of 56 member states. Our focus today is to examine the role of the Commonwealth in the 21st century on the African continent and beyond. Queen Elizabeth II's passing has ushered in a new era with King Charles III at the helm. However, is the Commonwealth still relevant? Does it provide a platform for positive change, or it is a relic of the past? Joining us for this enlightening conversation is Dr. Amuhaya Claire Ayuma and Ms. Arina Muresan. Together, we will look at important issues pertaining to the Commonwealth, such as its effectiveness as a global entity, principles of membership, and the balance of policies that may disproportionately affect countries of the Global South. We're happy to have you here. I'm going to start by asking you, can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thank you for having me, Aliu. My name is Dr. Claire Ayuma Muhaya. I'm a senior lecturer at the Rudin University. I'm also a researcher at our Center for Applied Global Transformation, and I'm also a visiting lecturer at the Higher School of Economics.
Thank you so much for having me this morning, Aliu. So, as you mentioned, my name is Irina Murison. I am a senior researcher at the Institute for Global Dialogue. We're a foreign policy-based think tank based in Pretoria, South Africa, and associated with UNISA.
So my first question goes to you, Ms. Muresan. Can you take us through what the Commonwealth is and why countries of the former British Empire decided to join the group despite their terrible past of colonialism, exploitation of resources with the Great Britain?
So this is a big question, and I hope I'm not going to sermonize or provide a whole academic lecture, but let's start with what is the Commonwealth? So it's an international association, currently at 56 members, the vast majority of which are former territories of the British Empire, from which it developed. And the Commonwealth Secretariat has a number of organizations, the Commonwealth Secretariat being one of them, focusing on intergovernmental aspects. The second one is the Commonwealth Foundation, focusing on non-governmental relations. And so it is really this kind of inclusion of former colonial partnerships and former colonies that have maintained a relationship with the Commonwealth or with Britain through the Commonwealth like that. Why did countries of the former British Empire decide to join despite this terrible past? I mean, that's another major question. And after colonialism ended legally, many say that it still has continued, depending on where you find yourself, really. Whether you view, the world and where you view the world philosophically from, so some still see the world as colonized, not neocolonialism, but a continued form of colonialism where there is a need to completely decolonialize. Okay, there's that view. And how this may look like will vary according from country, from person to person. Others view it in terms of residual vestiges, be it religion, other social historical ties that have allowed the world to be recolonialized under neocolonialism. And others believe it might be more important to pursue a pragmatic relationship. So after colonialism ended, colonial powers still wanted to hold a paternal role. And so many of the institutions maintained roles that could translate to other colonial powers' institutions and maintain this kind of strategic relationship. And today, for example, just the smallest example, you see it in the form of art, or antiques being housed in British museums or French museums, but for the purpose of this conversation, British museums, and it cannot be returned because African countries, for example, do not have storage capacity or equipment to maintain specific temperatures or preserve the antique. However, in the meantime, the British Museum benefits financially from such a collection. But to give you a brief answer to your question, this world is incredibly complicated, of course, and historical injustice is at times put aside so that a pragmatic existence allows countries, you know, a foothold in the global economy. If that is actually attained, it is yet to be seen, in my opinion. But in a short sense, I mean, pragmatism prevails in 2024.
Dr. Amuhaya, can you share your thoughts with us on this?
So the Commonwealth has undergone different transformations, but in essence, it was supposed to be the heir to the empire. By that, I mean, once colonialism was supposed to end, so the British are supposed to still maintain their relation with their former colonies. But the main reason why most of the African countries joined, if we put an example, Ghana was the first country to join the Commonwealth. And at independence, most of the African countries were really out to get a platform where they could promote their ideals. So in that context, maybe the Pan-African context, and as you can know, by 1957, not all countries were. Ghana, which was the first to gain independence and was also the first to join it, for Nkrumah, it was a platform that he could use to pursue one of its main agendas. And also, even the countries that were still thinking about independence, they were saying that they would still want relations, but one, they could be treated as equals. So they were not keen to get into relations as it was during colonialism. So I think Nkrumah played an important role in making other countries join. By that, I mean, when he joined in 57, he pushed for South Africa, which was still practicing apartheid. So he was adamant about South Africa not being a member of Commonwealth because of because of its apartheid policy. And actually, in 1961, he managed to get South Africa ousted from the Commonwealth. So when this happened, most of the African countries felt finally they'd found an organization where they could feel either treated as equals. So by the time South Africa was being ousted in 1961, Nigeria was also the only other African country that was a member. So immediately after that, when most of the countries were gaining independence, they joined. So for example, Sierra Leone in 61, Tanzania in 61 as well, I think Uganda 62, my country Kenya, I think 63, immediately we got independence. So the motivation then was that they thought they could, they found a platform where they could be able to speak about their own issues. Another thing that happened was that in 1965, I think they were also pushing for Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, because there was a policy that had been adopted that independence would only happen with majority in rule. But when Zimbabwe, I think the then Prime Minister, the Ian Smith, declared independence without, which was minority rule, the whites, not the Africans. They were really, really upset. And I think there were countries which had thought to get out of the Commonwealth, mainly Tanzania and Ghana as well. And Nkrumah had even sent individuals to go and speak to the British about Ghana to wanting to withdraw from the Commonwealth. But the High Commissioner of Ghana was not for this idea. So this meeting never took place. So in my opinion, I think if Ghana had left in 1965, then there would have been changes. Either more African countries would have left or others will not have joined. So Nkrumah played a huge role in terms of African countries joining the Commonwealth and or also staying within the Commonwealth. So that was the one of the main factors. I think the second thing is that the African countries needed trade. So they wanted a bigger platform where they could trade. As you know, British Empire to date is still the one of the largest in the world. So they had something about Commonwealth quota for trade or something like that. So the access for trade for most of the former colonies was going to be large, and they could only access it once they were members of the Commonwealth. So the other motivation was trade because of the huge market. I think the other main motivation was research and education, because most African countries were gaining independence, but they were still yet to establish their education sector. So there was a policy within the Commonwealth that they could get the Commonwealth studies within the Commonwealth countries. So the African countries' students could go to the Commonwealth countries for education in their universities. So I think these were some of the main motivation factors. Okay, apart from maybe also the organization, the Africans could use it to also learn governance skills, which at independence was very important.
Still with you, Dr. Amuhaya, can you tell us what the core principles of the Commonwealth are, and do they resonate with today's global challenges? And are these principles consistently applied among all members, or there are instances of double standards?
So when we think about the core principles, most of the African countries were joining in the 50s and 60s, I think the Commonwealth did not really have a set out core principle. The main core principles were set out in what they referred to as the Singapore Declaration, which I think it was in 1971. And it set out about 10 core principles. So as you mentioned, equality, then there was the issue about economic inequity. Then there was the issue about poverty eradication, disease, ignorance, end of colonialism, racism. So a list of principles, about 10. So those were the list that they stated as the core principles for the Commonwealth. But as you know, when we speak about even the economic or free trade, the Commonwealth had something that was called Commonwealth Development Cooperation, which was supposed to be funding and encourage economic development in the developing countries. But this never happened. Actually, there was an investigation to try to understand that department, and it was established that the members, by that I mean the members from the Global North, were the ones who had benefited and not the Commonwealth countries. It was eventually disbanded or joined or merged with the, I think, the British Foreign Commonwealth Development Office, FCDO. But anyway, the aim is that the key message is that at that time, there was an issue that there was really the funding that was supposed to help development in the Commonwealth countries didn't happen. What actually happened is that it ended up benefiting the developed states than the developing countries within the Commonwealth. So there have been issues of these principles not being taken up into consideration or not being applied unilaterally across the board.
Ms. Muresan, can you share your opinion with us?
So let's start with the principles, and the principles that they often speak to peace, liberty, human rights, equality, and equality and human rights from a gendered perspective as well, and free trade. Now, how this is upheld, how this is engaged upon, it varies, because at the end of the day, while it is a network that upholds certain values, it is also about bilateral relationships that countries have with each other, including the UK, including Britain specifically. And I suppose the biggest injustice many would speak about is the issue of trade. What does free trade really mean? While in the technicality, it means reducing the barriers in terms of, or financial barriers to trading, it does open up industries to quite a difficult position. For example, if you were to open up a developing industry, that is where it is at the biggest risk. And so this is where a lot refer to a specific injustice. Other injustices that others refer to are why, again, uphold this kind of relationship if we cannot have frank conversations with the British government about historical injustices. And some countries may feel that reparations should be paid, etc. So again, this could be quite a loaded question in terms of, are they double standards? I mean, double standards in international relations is quite a norm, I would say. It's very hard to speak on an equal footing without saying, but what about this? So yeah.
So what additional motives might exist for the British government's involvement in the Commonwealth beyond its historical ties and trade? Could there be some geopolitical agenda or the spread of the English language?
So actually, I think, you know, the spread of the English language was already spread under colonialism. Is there an agenda to further spread English? I wouldn't say so, because of such prominence it holds in business as a big business language internationally, in terms of a language to study under. I don't think there is a geopolitical aim to continue to kind of enforce it, because it already is quite established. But if you think about the Commonwealth association to English and countries of the Commonwealth using English, it's not enforceable, but as, you know, colonies, they have this kind of socio-historical tie to each other, to England. And that kind of also feeds into the geopolitical relationships they have. Does this mean that the Commonwealth is part of the geopolitical agenda of England? Absolutely. I feel that there is a need for England to improve its image and break away from this kind of image as a former colonizer, even though colonialism is living history for many people. And perhaps this is a way to sustain a positive image of the monarchy, which is, some would say, the bedrock of British culture. It provides a sense of solidarity, of national identity, creates tourism. And the support of the monarchy has also fallen to a historic low. Now, why do I speak about the monarchy? I mean, while the Commonwealth was really created upon the decolonial process, during colonialism, colonies would swear fealty to the crown, the British crown. And so the head of the Commonwealth is actually the monarch of Britain. And at the moment is Charles III. And there are 15 member states who are known as the Commonwealth realms, and 36 others who are known as republics, and 5 others who have different monarchs. But not all by default accept the monarch, the current reigning monarch. There needs to be a process where they say, okay, we accept. But coming back to the story of why it's important for the monarchy, I mean, as I mentioned, support for the monarchy has actually fallen to a historic low. There was a poll, actually, where something like 45% of respondents said the monarchy should either be abolished, that it was not important or not very important.
Dr. Amuhaya, can you give us your take on this?
Of course there is, because you have to understand when the Commonwealth, the African countries were joining, or even the former colonies of the British were joining the Commonwealth, there was already, we could state, something like a competition in Europe, because there was the European Economic Community, which is now the European Union. And at that time, it had already established, it also had the agenda to establish its relations with these former colonies. And by that, I mean main countries was Italy, Germany, France. So they were already forming trade relations with their former colonies. So for Britain, which was not part of the then European Economic Community, it had an agenda also for it to form its own trade relations with its former colonies. And if you look at how it was supposed to be, in as much as Britain says it was going to give access to the Commonwealth countries in the market, but the main idea was for the Britain to have access to raw materials in their former colonies. And this really impacted in the former colonies because, as you know, if you take out your raw materials, you're not able to industrialize, because your industrialization should be with the use of your raw materials. So once you give raw materials to someone else, then the industrial development was not able to take place in most of the former colonies. So there was the agenda. There was already the competition within Europe itself, and Britain needed to still maintain its grasp in its former colonies. The issue of English, I don't really think was major, is still major, because in most of these countries, in as much as English is the official language in some of these countries, it has never been the main issue in terms of the countries to be in Commonwealth. Because as you know, right now, the membership has extended to countries without who are not even former colonies. So, for example, Mozambique, their language is Portuguese. Togo, Gabon were the latest addition, and I think Rwanda. All these, Rwanda, I know it changed its official language to English, but the rest, I don't think they have. So it's really not, it might be the common feature among the countries, but the agenda was not really the English language.
So Dr. Amuhaya, you mentioned they needed to keep receiving raw materials. So are you implying that the exploitation continued even after the end of colonialism in Africa?
Yes, the exploitation continued. And as I said, this was also as a result of what was even happening in Europe itself. So there was a competition between the one which now is the European Union and the Britain. And even when Britain joined the European Union, it also went there with its former colonies. You know, we now have the Organization for African, Caribbean and Pacific States. So when Britain joined, it went with the argument that it was going to protect its Commonwealth countries in that agreement. But even now, Britain has left that union. And now it has to go back to start negotiating with these countries also on its own. So it's really how the Europe in general was still trying to maintain its grip within the former colonies, not necessarily African countries, because when you look at it's the African, Caribbean and Pacific states. So it's really, really huge. And I think it's one of the main largest political associations ever established. And it's not even trade anymore for now, because it has expanded to include politics and social issues. So the agenda has really expanded.
So to say that though the lion has left the savannah, its shadow still looms over the grassland. So what is the role of the more developed countries like Australia, Canada and New Zealand within the Commonwealth? Do they have more benefits and privileges than their counterparts from the Global South?
Yes, of course, because as I said, for example, there is the issue about the Commonwealth It was called the Commonwealth Development Corporation, something like that, the issue to do with funds. And when it was, as I told, it was abolished in just recently, that in 2020, it was merged with the Development Office for Britain. But this institution, which was supposed to help with the funding for economic development in the Commonwealth countries, the developing countries in the Commonwealth countries, that was not happening. So it was benefiting mainly the developed countries within the Commonwealth. So it was benefiting, as you stated, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and UK the most. So the developing countries within Commonwealth did not benefit from this funding. And this could be because they were supposed to establish either industries within the Commonwealth countries or startup businesses within the Commonwealth countries to assist the developing Commonwealth countries. But if there was any business that were being established, they did not assist the developing countries. Instead, they were the ones who were benefiting. So, and then there's another thing when you speak about the core principles, they've also been pushing for their own agendas in the core principles. Because, for example, I think in 1989, they had a declaration on environment. And this declaration on environment was mainly pushed by those four countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and UK. Because the issues about environment are not similar for the challenges for the developing countries and the challenges for developed countries are not similar. So they've also used this platform to pursue their own agenda, and the issue about environment is one of them, because it's not a problem or a challenge for the developing countries, and they cannot have a common policy on such issues. So how they would want to respond to environment challenges are not similar, and this is also a challenge, because sometimes the Commonwealth has been used to push agendas for many that resonate only with a few and not all.
Relations between countries and policies in such organizations should be based on mutual benefit. However, here it is a very different situation. So my next question to you is, recently there was an agreement signed between the UK and Rwanda on the extradition of migrants to Rwanda for processing of documents, as they said. So which has largely been criticized as racist and violates international law. So what is your opinion on this, considering the fact that the majority of migrants moving to the UK are citizens of the Commonwealth?
Well, as I told you first, we have to think about Rwanda's accession to the Commonwealth. As I said, I think it is the second country which didn't have any background with Britain. By that I mean in terms of colonialism. But then it joined, I think, in 2009. And there was something that was established here in office. It was established in 1999. And the first country was South Africa, I think, followed by Australia. Anyway, the African countries that have ever been chair in office is South Africa, Nigeria, Uganda. But already, Rwanda that joined 2009, it was already decided in 2020 that it was going to be the chair in office. So you could see that as a new member, and they've been members, they've been countries which have been members since 1960s, but they've never been chair in office. And Rwanda, just the new member, suddenly became the chair in office. And it was supposed to host the annual meeting, I think, in 2020, but due to COVID, it didn't happen. It happened in 2022. And then there was the issue when Rwanda joined, they cited that, oh, it has human rights issues, but still it was accepted. So in this, we see the double standards in the sense of the countries like UK, which would say, oh, we are pushing for human rights issues and all that. So they would be, on the other hand, be speaking as if they're condemning Rwanda. But then on the other side, we see the same country that you condemn is the same country you want to send individuals to, which doesn't even make sense. Because if you think the country has human rights violations, then you shouldn't even be encouraging other countries to go there. What I'm trying to say is that there have been instances where there's some Commonwealth position and then there's some bilateral position. So in the case of UK and Rwanda deal, there might be other issues apart from what we could think about that motivated the reasons for this agreement to be reached. But nevertheless, I presume if the UK, they perceive this as a challenge, the migration challenge, then they would find a solution. And if Rwanda has accepted, then they will just do that. If it will not be Rwanda, then they'll look for another partner. But they will try to pursue their agenda, whichever way they deem fit.
So moving further, there is an issue of growing concern. There are reports of funding cuts to countries who refused to legalize or have enacted anti-LGBT laws. Could this be perceived as an imposition of ideals on these countries, considering their social and cultural difference with the UK and its Western partners?
Actually, it is. And it's good you mentioned it, because I think, for example, the first country, not the first, but maybe one of the countries to withdraw because of this issue might be the Gambia. Yeah, I think the Gambia, they had gone to the UN, and I think the then president was really not pushing forward the issue about gay rights, which the UK was pushing forward with. And then immediately after, it was sanctioned. And I think, I don't remember if it was suspended or it withdrew, but I know Gambia was among the first to do this. So the Commonwealth has used its position sometimes to impose on countries either to pursue its own agenda or not. So the issue of sanctions, I think they did the same to Zimbabwe in terms of the issuing of sanctions. As you stated, now Uganda and Ghana are really strong on the issue about the anti-gay issues. And they try to use fund or aid to make states either to go with the ideas or not. But as I said, you have to understand these states. There are some positions which they would take as Commonwealth and they would really condemn them. But they also understand about the need for bilateral relations. So they could condemn as a body in Commonwealth, but then they would go back behind the scenes and have the bilateral relations with these states, which are different from their position in Commonwealth. That sometimes happened. And I remember there was a former Commonwealth Secretary General who was being interviewed, and he stated it's one of the dilemmas they have while working within the Commonwealth. So you could have a Commonwealth position where you decide, okay, we are giving sanctions or we are condemning Uganda for this and this. And then they go and have their own bilateral relations. Or sometimes they could condemn it within their own position in bilateral relations. So, for example, UK could condemn Uganda, but then in the Commonwealth, it is not possible because maybe the decision is not unanimous. So these are some of the challenges that happen when it comes to bilateral relations and the Commonwealth agenda. Sometimes they don't merge. But there have been instances where states try to pursue their own states' interest in the Commonwealth.
Ms. Muresan, what do you have to say about this?
Absolutely. Look, it can immediately be perceived as flexing an economic muscle, your smart power, in order to either punish a country for not upholding certain principles. It could be perceived as that, absolutely. But at the same time, these countries wanting to be part of a Commonwealth have also signed on to upholding certain principles. This does not preclude them privilege of having their own national legal system, their own cultural way of engaging people within their own country. And this is where debates around sovereignty, debates around how much a country can, for example, Britain through the Commonwealth and retracting funding or making less funding available. This is where they do definitely become criticized for their actions, whether it solves a geopolitical purpose. It actually does not, in terms of Britain's role internationally and the kind of values it hopes to uphold. It does speak to specific values and how they uphold human rights and how they uphold equality as well. And this is a very, perhaps, Western lens of seeing how an individual can pursue life. And perhaps this is where they would argue that international law needs to be upheld in this kind of manner. However, they would not go as far because it's engaging very closely in the national politics and laws of another country.
So my final question to both of you, starting with you, Ms. Moresan, can you tell us the role of the Commonwealth in resolving disputes among member states? As within countries of the Commonwealth, there are disputes, for example, between India and Pakistan. So does the Commonwealth play any political or military role in ending these disputes?
This is also a big question. I mean, the irony is that Britain created this conflict or tension between India and Pakistan. And to look at it a little bit about the history before we touch on what is the Commonwealth role in this, the conflict between India and Pakistan came from the 1947 partition of British India. And so in the kind of representation, representation, it became clear that Britain could no longer afford to administer India, and it wanted to leave as quickly as possible. I mean, the financial burden on Britain was too high, and the British used religion as a way of dividing people in India into categories during its colonial rule. And they created, you know, separate Muslim and Hindu lists for voters for local elections, and seats were reserved for Muslim politicians and seats for Hindu politicians, and religion became a fundamental factor in politics. And when it looked like that, like India would be getting this independence, many Muslim Indians became worried that living in a country ruled by a Hindu majority, they would not find their space there. And Muslim Indians started to support political leaders who campaigned for a separate Muslim homeland. And when the partition took place, there were waves of killings and mass internal displacement because many people within those religions were scattered within India. And there were several wars. I mean, there was the Indo-Pakistani War in 1947. There was another one in 1965, 1970, 1999. And every single time a fragile ceasefire would be brokered or broken thereafter, you'd see various skirmishes isolated, and the tensions have continued to this day. Now, what is the role of the Commonwealth here? Because Britain almost created, quote unquote, this problem. Both India and Pakistan are actually part of the Commonwealth, right? Britain has not actually acknowledged its role in creating fundamental issues such as this, using religions to divide people or categorize people that led to further division. In addition to that, creating a separate homeland, etc. But it also hasn't abandoned either as a trade or development partner, and both have been, you know, part of the broader Commonwealth network of institutions and its sourcing of funds and experts and training. And so you see the Commonwealth engagement in this kind of relationship on a bilateral level, where countries would have access to development finance for development means. But in addition to that, does it play a security or political or military role? It's very tentative because becoming involved militaristically, it sends a very strong message as well. And I do think that Britain is incredibly apprehensive to play that kind of role and broker this kind of agreement with the help of the military. I do think that there is a kind of apprehension to do that. But I do think that there is always opportunity for dialogue, but it also depends on what India and Pakistan want from other members. When we talk about the Commonwealth, we do largely refer to Britain as the leader of this Commonwealth, but the Commonwealth of States is really bringing together a broader network and engaging diplomatically as well. So whether other members have an engagement between both parties, India and Pakistan, to resolve any kind of political and political disputes, if that win-win that rather arises, it's really up to the countries engaged to invite others into the room and engage further. Of course, it's always going to be part of a diplomatic discussion, a political discussion, but whether they invite others in to resolve this politically, diplomatically, that is a more formal matter.
So, Dr. Amukhaya, your thoughts?
The issue about political disputes, when countries joined the Commonwealth, the idea was that it's a voluntary association. So the Commonwealth as a body was not supposed to involve itself in the political disputes of its member states. And the issue that you raise about Pakistan and India is really crucial, because when both joined the Commonwealth, it was one of the most heightened discussions in the Commonwealth, because India knew already that Commonwealth shouldn't get involved in the disputes, but Pakistan was pushing for this dispute they were having to be resolved within Commonwealth. So they really tried and they couldn't discuss them in the agendas when they went for the meeting. But eventually, I think after several years, it was decided that they would discuss it, but outside of the meeting. And we know the results, because after that, each party came up with its own understanding of what happened in the meeting. But ideally, at the start, the Commonwealth was not supposed to get involved in the political disputes. But as it has evolved and issues have changed, we see more and more its involvement in the political issues. So I think in 2002, they established what they call Commonwealth Good Offices or something like that, where the Secretary General would appoint special envoys, and they could send them to some of these countries to try either to mediate or to try to find a solution to some of the political disputes. So I think the one was sent to Guyana in 2002, and they had an issue. I think Maldives as well. But the India and Pakistan issue, as I said, it's really controversial, and it takes me back to, as I said, when Pakistan had a coup in 2000, and there was a time there was a coup, and it was removed from the Commonwealth. But you remember when they needed Pakistan at the time when they wanted the Taliban, the issue with Osama bin Laden. So the positions that they were taking in the Commonwealth and the positions that they were adopting as bilateral were a bit different. So the Commonwealth was not supposed to get involved in the political disputes, but as time goes by, it increasingly gets involved in the political disputes of the member states, but not actively in the sense of sending troops or all that, but just trying to send special envoys to have a discussion with the countries which have disputes.
In conclusion, our discussion with Dr. Amuhaya Claire Amuya and Arina Muresan shed light on the issues surrounding the Commonwealth and their implications for member states. Dr. Amuhaya went on to highlight discrepancies in funding for development and imposition of agendas, exposing the Commonwealth's double standards. Despite pushing for human rights and equality, the Commonwealth's actions frequently serve its own interests. The researcher cited instances where member states have faced sanctions or pressure for policies deemed unfavorable by Western powers. This creates concerns about the bloc's commitment to addressing systematic inequalities. Dr. Amuhaya further emphasizes the Commonwealth's complicity in maintaining colonial legacies such as resource extraction and economic exploitation. She explained how the institution's policies and practices have contributed to the underdevelopment of former colonies, hindering their ability to achieve genuine economic sovereignty and self-determination. According to Ms. Muresan, the tensions between India and Pakistan is a consequence of British rule and has remained unresolved. The Commonwealth's role in mediating such disputes remains limited, raising questions about its effectiveness in addressing these legacies of its past. The future of the Commonwealth hinges on its ability to confront these challenges. Before we wrap up today's episode, I invite you to listen to our quote of the day by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Desmond Tutu was a well-known South African theologian and anti-apartheid campaigner who was honored for his unwavering commitment to justice and peace. He was instrumental in the fight against apartheid, using his moral power to organize global support for freedom and equality in South Africa. Tutu's legacy is defined by his unrelenting devotion to peace, human rights, and social justice, making him a global symbol of hope and resilience.
Dear friends, let's not kid ourselves. In a situation of injustice and oppression, there can be no neutrality. You have to take sides. You have to say, am I on the side of justice or am I on the side of injustice? When an elephant is sitting on the tail of a mouse and you say, I am neutral, the mouse is not going to be particularly pleased about your neutrality. You have already made a decision. You have decided to be on the side of the powerful, of the elephant. There is no neutrality. They talk about reforming apartheid. We are not interested in reforming apartheid. You don't reform a Frankenstein, you destroy a Frankenstein.
Thank you for tuning into Global South Pole. Do not forget to subscribe to our Telegram channel at Sputnik Africa, and you can listen to all episodes of Global South Pole on our site and on various platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, Castbox, Pocket Cast, AfriPods, Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Google Podcasts. Until next time, goodbye.